Before we get on with today's episode of Morbidology, I'd like to talk about today's sponsor, Unidragon. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles, and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. They were a sponsor of an earlier episode of Morbidology, where I spoke about their amazing nature and animal-related jigsaw puzzles. Well, since then, they've added some fantastic new jigsaw puzzle designs, such as the Sakura, which is a gorgeous cherry blossom scene, and my personal favourite, Planet Earth, which is a picturesque Earth design as seen from outer space, as well as Milky Whales, which is a super cool design of colourful whales. Over the past couple of months, I've really started to enjoy jigsaw puzzles. They're a great way to pass the time, they're fun, and they're a low-stakes activity, which can help reduce anxiety and increase your memory and problem-solving skills. So head on over to unidragon.com or click the link in my show notes and use the code DRAGONB4 for 10% off. That's DRAGONB4 for 10% off. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. The purpose of the police is to protect and serve. Imagine if you were being attacked, you would call 911 under the assumption that they would send somebody to protect you. However, in Dallas, Texas, in 2012, a woman called police for assistance. Her desperation and fear were audible as she screamed for her life. It took over 50 minutes for officers to respond to the scene, and even then, they simply knocked on the door and then left. The case would raise many questions about how 911 calls are handled, and would reveal systemic problems in the 911 call center of Dallas, sparking change for the better. It was around 10:51 a.m. on the 17th of August, 2012, when police in Dallas, Texas, received a phone call from 32-year-old Deanna Cook. Deanna was screaming and shouting for her life while a man can be heard in the background. I'm about to play a portion of this 911 call. I'd like to warn you that it is extremely disturbing and quite inaudible, but it would play an integral role in the case. At one point, Deanna could be heard screaming, "Delvecchio, why are you doing this?" as well as, "Red, please stop, I didn't do anything to you." Deanna can then be heard choking as a man in the background scowls, "I'll kill you," repeatedly.
"Please, Delvecchio! Delvecchio, please! Please, Delvecchio! Please, Delvecchio, please!
We're holding
you. I'm not doing nothing to you!
Fuck you.
After 11 minutes, the line went dead. The 911 operator allegedly alerted responding officers, Senior Corporal Julia Menchaca and Amy Wilburn, to the severity of the situation. But when they arrived at the home on the 9300 block of Crimson Court, there was no answer at the front door. Following the 911 call, Deanna seemingly vanished. She ignored phone calls from friends and family, and then 2 days later, when she didn't show up for church, their concern escalated into fear. Deanna's mother, Vicky Cook, spoke with Crime Watch Daily.
August the 17th was a Friday. She used to call me around 10, 11 every day when she'd be driving for her job, and this particular day she didn't call. I said, that's not like Deanna. I said, and she haven't called me. I said, so can y'all please help me try to find Deanna?
The family went over to Deanna's home. Once again, there was no answer at the front door. However, they noticed that water was flowing from underneath the front door. But since all of the doors and windows were locked, there was no way in. Deanna's mother, Vicky, placed a phone call to 911, asking for an officer to come out to the home and conduct a welfare check.
Dallas 911, what's your emergency?
My daughter has been missing since Friday.
No, what is your daughter?
She is 32.
Okay, have you called all the jails and hospitals?
No, I have not. I'm at her house.
Okay, let me give you the number to the jail and hospital. Once you check Parkland and Luke Berry, if she's not there, you call us back.
Ma'am, can you just send the police over here?
No, ma'am, you have to do this first.
The 911 operator informed her that she would need to place a phone call to hospitals and jails before she could send an officer out. Deanna's family couldn't wait any longer and decided to kick in the front door. They followed the noise of the rushing water into the bathroom, where they found Deanna dead in the bathtub. Deanna's two teenage daughters were among the family members to find the body. Deanna's body would be taken to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined. The autopsy would reveal that Deanna had died from drowning as well as other homicidal violence. Her manner of death was ruled a homicide. Unsurprisingly, suspicion immediately fell onto Deanna's ex-husband, Delvecchio Patrick, the man who was clearly identified during Deanna's earlier 911 call. He was immediately arrested, charged with murder, and held on $500,000 bail. The relationship between Deanna and Delvecchio had been marred by domestic violence. Deanna had filed for divorce back in May of 2011, and it was finalized in January of 2012. In January of 2009, Delvecchio had shown up at Deanna's home, while her friend, Chamara Ingram, was visiting for the afternoon. He arrived at the home and flew into a rage at Deanna. He began to scream and shout about how she hadn't answered the phone when he had called her. Deanna had tried to calm the situation down, but there was no calming Delvecchio down. Deanna fled the situation and locked herself in the bedroom, but Delvecchio followed and kicked down the bedroom door. He grabbed Deanna by the throat and pushed her up against the bedroom wall. Chamara shouted at Delvecchio to let Deanna go, and he responded by telling her to shut up, or he would do the same to her. When Delvecchio did let Deanna go, he went to the kitchen and grabbed a knife and threatened that he was going to do it. By this point, Chamara had rushed outside to call police. When officers arrived at the scene, they spoke with Deanna, who confirmed what had happened. The officer noticed that there were clear finger mark impressions on Deanna's neck, and that her voice was raspy, indicating that she certainly had been strangled. Deanna was given a family violence package, and she requested a protective order against Delvecchio. He was arrested, but was released on $25,000 bond just the following month. Accusations of violence would surface once again, almost as soon as Delvecchio was released. That same month, Delvecchio strangled Deanna once again, and she asked him to leave their home. Then the following month, Delvecchio phoned Deanna hundreds of times. He threatened to murder her in front of her children, and then have his friends come over and sexually assault her children. In August of the same year, he showed up at Deanna's home, choked her, stole her purse, and then phoned her mother and threatened to kill her. Following these three incidents, a judge would increase Delvecchio's bond to $150,000 and made him subject to an electronic monitoring tag. In October of that year, Deanna filed for divorce. Several months later, she wrote to the court and asked them to serve the divorce papers to Delvecchio in jail, stating, "I really need this divorce, please." However, this was dismissed when Deanna didn't follow through. A couple of months later, Delvecchio filed a handwritten petition seeking divorce, but this too was also dismissed when he didn't follow through. Then late at night, on the 20th of March 2010, Deanna ran over to her neighbour's home. She was wearing only a bra and her underwear as she pounded on Shamika Alexander's front door, screaming, "He's trying to kill me!" Shamika opened the front door to Deanna and immediately noticed that she was riddled in bruises and was shaking like a leaf. She glanced out the front door and saw Delvecchio, but as soon as she let Deanna in, he ran away. When police spoke with Delvecchio, he claimed that Deanna had assaulted him and that he had only ran away from the scene because he had a warrant. It was discovered that Delvecchio had a slight stab wound to the back of his shoulder, as well as some wounds to his mouth, a laceration on his tongue and scratches on his face. Police would find a weapon which could have plausibly caused these injuries. It was a tire ream, similar to an ice pick, and it was found inside Deanna's home. While Deanna was covered in bruises and was adamant that Delvecchio had attacked her first, and she was just trying to defend herself, police arrested her at the scene. However, Deanna would be acquitted of the assault. There were no reports of violence between this date and May of 2011, simply because Delvecchio was in jail. In April of 2011, Delvecchio pleaded guilty to reduced misdemeanor charges in each of the earlier cases, in return for concurrent one-year jail sentences. However, Delvecchio had already completed those sentences through credit for time he had already spent in jail. Then in May of 2011, Deanna called police to report that Delvecchio had punched her numerous times, pulled her by her hair, and then threatened her with a crowbar. When police arrived at the scene, Deanna had injuries to her hands. She told the responding officer that when defending herself from Delvecchio's punches, he slashed them with a knife. Days later, Deanna once again filed for divorce, and in January of 2012, the judge granted the divorce. A couple of months after the divorce was finalized, Deanna called police to report Delvecchio for calling her 107 times and telling her that he was going to kill her. She told the 911 operator that he had threatened, "I'm going to make it to where you never mess with me again." 4 days later, Deanna called police once more to report that Delvecchio had used a stolen key to enter her home and steal her TV and alcohol. He was arrested on an outstanding warrant which was related to the assault he had committed in May of 2011. Was released on the 11th of July. On the 28th of July, Deanna called police and asked them to come to her home and escort Delvecchio away. He had been sitting in a park just across the road from her home and had spent much of the day sporadically knocking on her door and telling her that she better not go to work. Deanna said that Delvecchio had been outside all day and she didn't know what he was planning on doing, adding that the 911 operator could look up her name and see that she had called about Delvecchio numerous times, yet nobody was doing anything to protect her.
911, this is Pat. What's your emergency?
I have a stalker. He's been out here all day long. He's been out here across the street watching my house. I don't know what his plan is. You can look up my name. You can see it's 100,000 complaints, but ain't nobody doing nothing.
She said to the 911 operator that she didn't want Delvecchio to know that she had called them, because as she said, it triggered him and caused him to tear stuff up in her house. Officer Brad Callio arrived at the scene and found Delvecchio sitting in the park. He had 2 bags of clothes with him and informed the officer that he was waiting for his niece to come and pick him up. The officer drove Delvecchio to his stepfather's house, but no charges were ever filed. Deanna had called police numerous times in the past, looking for protection from Delvecchio. On one call, she had informed the 911 operator that Delvecchio had tried to murder her 3 times in the past, and that she was fed up with him and always trying to hide from him. Delvecchio had gone to jail a handful of times before following his release. He had always come after Diana. Do you grind your teeth in your sleep? If so, you're one of the 40 million Americans who do. There are a number of causes, such as stress, anxiety, or even an abnormal bite. Grinding your teeth can sadly cause a number of problems, such as worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental problems. According to dentists, the number one teeth grinding prevention is a custom-fitted night guard. However, these can be very costly, with the average dentist charging around $200 to $300 per night guard, and you can grind through several of those a year. That's where today's sponsor, Smile Brilliant, comes in. Smile Brilliant uses a lab direct process to bring you the same custom fitted night guard, but for as little as $45 per night guard. In addition, they also have custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electronic toothbrush. For me personally, taking care of my teeth is of utmost importance, and Smile Brilliant make it straightforward and affordable. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com and use the promo code MORBIDOLOGY to check out for 30% off. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com and use code MORBIDOLOGY for 30% off your order. If you're like me, sometimes you need a break when listening to true crime. Well, what could be better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads. It truly seems like everybody is playing it, and I think that you should too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you make your way through the levels, you collect cute little monsters that you can evolve. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I'm out walking my dog. I'm already on level 261. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. When the earlier 911 call that Diana had placed before her murder came to the surface, people were, of course, outraged. With a phone call like that, why had it taken 2 days to find Diana's body? Dallas PD announced that they would be conducting a comprehensive review of the 911 call, which would include the process that was followed by the communications personnel, as well as the patrol officers in response to the phone call. Their preliminary review into the 911 call determined that Diana had placed the call from her cell phone, and as a result, the 911 operator did not know her exact address. The operator also said that they had attempted to obtain the address from Diana, while simultaneously conducting a search of previous calls from the same phone number to try and determine Diana's address. As you heard in the phone call, Diana was being attacked and was screaming for her life. The excuse that Diana did not relay her address was an extremely lackluster excuse, but by this point in the investigation, the phone call hadn't been publicly released. The preliminary review also found that the 911 operator had notified the 911 on-duty supervisor of the issue, and the call was forwarded to the dispatcher but could not be dispatched to field officers until an address was determined. Once the address was determined, the 911 operator updated the call information so that the call could then be dispatched. They said that the process of obtaining the address and updating the call information took approximately 9 minutes. After getting the address, the dispatcher gave the call to the first available police field element. The preliminary review found that the officers who received the call arrived at Diana's home, knocked the door, but received no reply. They attempted to call Diana back, but the call went straight to voicemail. The officers checked the perimeters of the building and spoke with Deanna's neighbors, all of whom reported nothing out of the ordinary. Dallas PD announced that they were looking into whether the nature of the 911 call was sufficiently communicated through each step of the process to the responding officers, and whether their response was appropriate based on the information they were provided by the 911 operator. It would be uncovered that the responding officers didn't actually know how severe the situation was and how disturbing the phone call had been. They believed that they were going to a domestic disturbance call. Apparently, the 911 operator believed that she had escalated the call to a lights and sirens priority one, but somewhere between her screen and the officers, this did not happen. Instead, the phone call went out as a priority two, which is typical for domestic disturbances. Furthermore, the responding officers did not reach Deanna's home until 50 minutes after she placed that desperate phone call. By that point, Deanna was already dead. Friends and family of Deanna strongly criticized the police for not doing more to try and help Deanna when she called 911. Her friend Lakeisha Davis said, "That's negligence. They kick in your door for everything else. It needs to be investigated." Another friend, Cherquinita Crawford, also raised concerns about how the 911 call was handled, stating that it was evident by Deanna's screams on the phone call that she was clearly in no position to answer the front door and was clearly in severe danger. She said, "If I call, I'm being attacked. I want you to kick in the front door. It was a murder taking place. You get to that house by any means necessary." Following the revelation, the 911 operator, Tonita Hopkins, defended herself in an interview with the Dallas Morning News. She said that because of the screaming, she knew it was an act of disturbance, but said that she didn't know exactly what was going on. She stated, "Obviously my prayers go out to her family, because that's just a terrible situation." While the handling of the call was still under investigation, actions were immediately taken based on the preliminary review. A new call classification was created with the purpose of strengthening the communication between 911 operators, police dispatchers, and field officers. This new call classification was in relation to a disturbance call involving imminent serious bodily injury or death and required an emergency response. It would increase the priority to the highest level wherein a call is dispatched, and authorized field officers would respond with a code 3, which meant that they would respond with their emergency lights and sirens activated. A number of Dallas City leaders called for an investigation into the 911 emergency call system. In fact, this wasn't the first time that questions had been raised in Dallas regarding 911 responses. Back in June of 2011, miscommunication led to Stephen Jones shooting at 3 Dallas police officers, who he erroneously believed were breaking into his home. Then in July of the same year, a home in Dallas burned to the ground after there was a delay in sending out fire trucks. Dallas City Council member Dwayne Carraway stated, "Certainly, people must understand that when people call and are in distress, we have to have a much better temperament and professionalism about ourselves in knowing how to best handle those circumstances." On the 23rd of August, Deanna was laid to rest. Around 200 people packed into St. John Missionary Baptist Church to commemorate her life. Apostle Billy Creed said to the mourners, "Because of her, people are going to be saved. Police are going to try to prevent something like this from happening again." Apostle Great was one of the last people to speak with Deanna. Shortly before she was murdered, she had placed a phone call to the prayer line. Deanna was subsequently buried at Laurel Land Cemetery. Standing at the gravesite, a number of Deanna's loved ones reminisced about her life. Apostle Great said that Deanna had turned a corner in her life and was devoted to God in the recent years. He said, "I saw a transition in this woman. She probably didn't have a clue that her life touched so many people." A couple of hours after the funeral, Deanna's sisters Carlitha Cook Grundy and Felicia Battle, spoke with CNN. They said that their sister had called 911 numerous times in the past to report abuse at the hands of Delvecchio. They said that on the phone call, she was pleading for her life and choking and did not deserve the low-priority response that she got. Early the following month, it was announced that Tonita, the 911 operator, had been suspended for 10 days for how the call was handled. It was also announced that Angelia Herod-Graham, the 911 operator who had taken the phone call from Vicky before she found Deanna's body, was fired. She had been the 911 operator to tell Vicky to check hospitals and jails before they could send a police officer over to conduct a welfare check. While Police Chief David Brown was adamant that there were no staffing issues within the 911 call centre, it would be uncovered that the call centre had been chronically understaffed for a number of years. Because of this, 911 operators had been working overtime. In fact, people calling 911 at peak times would be met with a pre-recorded message, telling them to wait for the next available operator. The city was authorised to have 90 workers in the communications section, but there were only 64 positions filled. Deanna's family would file a federal lawsuit against the city and the police department. They alleged that the 911 system, as well as the police officers sent to Deanna's home, had failed to do their jobs. They also accused the police department of failing to properly train their 911 operators on how to deal with domestic violence phone calls. They revealed that two officers who had responded to the call had stopped at a suspected burglary and at a convenience store to purchase a bottle of water before responding to the 911 call from Deanna. The lawsuit also alleged that 911 calls in southern Dallas are handled differently than those in the northern sector. The family's lawyer, Aubrey Pittman, said the Dallas Police Department would not have had a delay of 50 minutes to an affluent North Dallas neighborhood. Towards the end of September, Chief Brown disciplined two supervisors in connection with the mishandling of the 911 call from Deanna. Veteran Lieutenant Todd Thomason was issued advice and instructions for failing to ensure that a supervisor was available to handle any potential difficult 911 calls when Deanna called for help. Veteran Lieutenant Thomason had conducted a meeting with 911 supervisor Kimberly Cole that day, and Kimberly had said that she left a senior call taker in charge that day. When questioned, Kimberly said that due to lack of staff, she had to leave a senior call taker in charge when she attended a meeting, leaving the floor with no supervisor at the time that Deanna's phone call came in. Chief Brown would subsequently move 50 senior officers into the 911 call center and said that 25 of those would spend the next 18 months in the center. He said that it wasn't an overhaul, but instead a review of each layer of the center. He additionally announced that they would be hiring new 911 operators. Meanwhile, Tonita, who had taken the 911 call from Deanna, resigned, and then in February of the following year, Angela, who took the 911 call from Vicky, went before a civil service board to try and get her job back. She claimed that she didn't detect the urgency in the phone call, stating, "I didn't refuse to send police. I did what I was trained to do." However, Lieutenant Ben Nabors testified that it was against Dallas Police Department policies to make families call around before sending officers to conduct a welfare check. He said that as soon as she had the relevant information, which she had very quickly in the phone call, then she should have sent police. Ultimately, her firing would be upheld. In March, the 911 call was leaked in the media. Mayor Mike Rawlings responded by saying, "We failed her. The system failed her. The neighbors next door failed her. The media failed her. The mayor failed her." He said that Deanna's murder was an example of a broader domestic violence problem that was plaguing Dallas, and said that they needed to change the dynamic in the city. As mentioned earlier, Deanna had called police numerous times looking for protection, but each time, Deanna was failed. Delvecchio went to jail a handful of times, but he always came back for Deanna. It was typical of the cycle of domestic violence. Of course, domestic violence does not discriminate when it comes to gender, race, or creed. However, according to statistics, Black women are at a far greater risk of becoming victim to domestic violence. In fact, they are around 3 times more likely to die at the hands of a partner or ex-partner than members of any other racial group. And domestic violence homicide is among the leading cause of death for Black women aged between 15 and 35 years old. Deanna's family would say that Deanna had been trying to escape from Delvecchio for years. Her mother Vicky said that her daughter had told her that Delvecchio had tried to kill her 3 times in the past and that she had moved house numerous times in a bid to get away from him, but to no avail. I've recently joined the new podcast app, Vodacast, and they've even sponsored this episode of Morbidology. Vodacast is a podcast app, but what sets it apart from other podcast apps is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. On Vodacast, not only can you listen to your favourite podcasts, but those episodes can come alive with supplemental digital content paired with that episode. With Vodacast, everything you want to know about that specific episode is right there on your fingertips. I know for me personally, when I finish an episode, I'll always go and Google image the people involved in the episode and read more about the case. But with Vodacast, you don't need to do that. So click the link in my show notes or just search for Vodacast on the App Store and check it out today. There were drastic improvements at the Dallas 911 Center. In addition to hiring new 911 operators and moving senior officers into the call center, starting salaries were boosted, the number of supervisors were increased, and upgraded equipment and technology was brought in. This led to a quicker response time in answering 911 calls. In early December of 2013, a pretrial hearing was held for Delvecchio. In court, it was the first time that Vicky had seen Delvecchio since he was accused of her daughter's murder. Delvecchio didn't want to appear in court due to the fact that cameras were allowed in the courtroom. There was a 90-minute delay before Delvecchio was ushered into the courtroom. He smiled at his attorney and then sat down without even glancing towards Deanna's family. He was ordered to stand trial in February of 2014. And outside of court, Deanna's family said that they were upset by Delvecchio's demeanor. They had hoped that he would show some semblance of remorse for what he had done, but he appeared to be totally unfazed. The murder trial would be delayed several more times before finally beginning in May of 2015. During opening statements, Prosecutor Trey Stock told the jury that they were going to leave the courtroom very angry at the Dallas Police Department and their failure to save Deanna. He played out the graphic 911 call that captured the final moments of Deanna's life. He informed the jury that Delvecchio's nickname was Red, as heard on the 911 call. Defense attorney Roger Lennox started his opening statements by apologizing for information he was going to present, which would be hurtful to Deanna's family. He said that Deanna was the aggressor and that Delvecchio was an innocent man. Deanna's mother Vicky testified on the first day. She took the jury through the moment she found her daughter's body.
When Carlita kicked the door in, the smell hit her and she just turned and ran. And I went in and the water, like, it was so high, it was covering my feet. I saw like a shadow behind the curtain, and I started screaming because it was her. And the water was still running. The water was still running. And I just said, he killed her. He said he was going to do it. And he did it. He did it. He did
it. Prosecutor Stock asked Vicky to identify the man's voice on the 911 call, who scowls, "I'll kill you." Vicky identified the voice as Delvecchio. Following her testimony was Dallas Police Officer Stanley Bryant, who was one of the first officers to arrive at the crime scene. He told the jury that he had taken photographs of the home to rule out forced entry. He described the main living area of the home as tidy and very organized, but said that the master bedroom was in complete disarray.
"I could tell it appeared that a disturbance had occurred because beds were pushed, things were disturbed all throughout that room.
There was a trash can and lamp knocked over on the floor, and the bed sheets had been pulled up, exposing the mattress. He said that based on the appearance of the bedroom, especially in comparison to the other tidy rooms, it was evident that some kind of struggle had taken place. The photographs of the bedroom and main living area were followed by photographs of the bathroom. There was a toothbrush on the floor and a trash can was knocked over. In the bathtub, Deanna's body was face down in bloody water. The next photograph caused a number of people in the courtroom to gasp, cry, and even leave the room. It was a photograph of Deanna's body turned over. She was bloated and disfigured. The prosecution would then call on two witnesses who had seen Deanna shortly before her murder. A postal worker testified that they had seen Deanna walking towards her home with a man around 15 minutes before Deanna placed the 911 call. She said she believed the man with Deanna was Delvecchio, but she couldn't be 100% sure. A neighbour of Deanna also testified that he had seen Delvecchio outside Deanna's home at around 11:30 a.m. that morning, around 15 minutes before police arrived at the scene. He said that he was wearing shorts, but he wasn't wearing a shirt or shoes. Prosecutor Stock would then call Dallas Police Detective Derek Cheney to the witness stand. Detective Cheney went to school with Delvecchio, and the prosecutor asked him to try and identify his voice on the 911 call. He compared the phone call to phone calls that Delvecchio had made from jail, including one wherein he spoke about wrestling women down and using submission moves on them, but also saying that he doesn't use his fists to beat women. Detective Cheney identified the voice on the 911 call as Delvecchio and pointed him out in the courtroom. A cell phone expert would then testify that Deanna's phone had pinged to cell phone towers near her home shortly before her death, and then pinged to cell phone towers near the home of Delvecchio's father in Batch Springs. Her phone was never found, but prosecutors implied that based on this evidence, Delvecchio had stolen her phone after killing her. Much of the testimony would focus on the prior domestic violence reports between the couple, which I detailed earlier on in this episode. In all of these instances, except for one, Delvecchio had been arrested as the aggressor. In the case where Deanna was arrested, she had been acquitted of the charges against her. The defense would try and paint Deanna as a drug user who suffered from mental illness and was prone to violence. They first of all called on the police officer who had arrested Deanna. On that occasion, Deanna had run to her neighbour's home in her bra and underwear after Delvecchio had attacked her. She was covered in bruises and Delvecchio fled from the scene, but it was Deanna who was arrested. While he was called as a defence witness, he testified that he was worried about Deanna's safety because of the volatile nature of the couple's relationship. The defense also called on Dr. Krista Compton, a forensic psychologist who did a psychological autopsy on Deanna by looking at her medical records and police reports. She testified that Deanna had been diagnosed as bipolar and schizophrenic, with evidence of PCP and cannabis abuse.
There's a range of conditions that Ms. Cook exhibited, and it led to a host of behaviors and lifestyle choices and sometimes erratic behaviors that were self-destructive.
She said that the combination of drugs and mental illness could lead to erratic and self-destructive behavior. The defense tried and suggest that Deanna was never actually attacked by anybody and that she had imagined she was being attacked by Delvecchio. Under cross-examination, however, Dr. Compton agreed that a man's voice could clearly be heard on the 911 call. They also called on members of Delvecchio's family, who said that Diana could be unpredictable and violent. Delvecchio's uncle, Alan Hall, testified that on one occasion she had shown up to his house with a machete.
She was always threatening, you know. She didn't like the family.
The prosecution would bring in a rebuttal witness, Jimmy Hardaway, who worked as a jail nurse, when she overheard Delvecchio admit to the murder.
They say I murdered somebody and I didn't do it. And then Mr. Patrick said, I did. And Mr. Stoker kind of looked at him and he said, I killed that.
Toxicologist Gary Wimbish would testify that Diana's toxicology report showed evidence of PCP in her system, but he couldn't determine how long ago she had taken the drug. The defense would try and put forward a theory that Diana could have died from a mixture of PCP and alcohol. However, this would be refuted by the medical examiner who had conducted Diana's autopsy. He said that PCP was not a factor in Diana's death, and that she had died from homicidal violence, including drowning. The prosecution kept going back to the 911 call throughout the trial. It was such a strong piece of evidence, with Diana naming who was attacking her and the male voice being heard down the end of the line. During the closing arguments, prosecutor Kendall Costello told the jury to imagine Diana kneeling down in nothing but her underwear as Delvecchio ran a bath and then drowned her in it. He said, with her last dying breath, Diana Cook sealed the fate of Delvecchio Patrick. After suffering years of abuse, after repeated efforts to extract herself from this man's hands, Delvecchio Patrick killed Diana Cook. Defense Lennox, on the other hand, simply suggested that Diana had passed out in the bathtub and drowned. He attempted to undermine the jail nurse, calling her an attention-seeking liar, and said that Diana's mother, Vicky, only identified his voice because she was driven by extreme vengeance. The prosecution rebuffed the closing argument and ridiculed the defense's position, calling their theories offensive. Prosecutor Stock stated, I find it absolutely incredible that someone could listen to that 911 tape and come up before you with a straight face and tell you that Diana Cook did not die a traumatic death. It would take the jury just 3 hours and 20 minutes to reach a verdict. They found Delvecchio Patrick guilty of the murder of Diana Cook. He showed no reaction, much like for the entirety of the trial, as the verdict was read out. The sentencing phase of the trial would be just a few days later, and the jury would sentence Delvecchio to 85 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. Following the decision, Delvecchio began to smile. He was lambasted by Diana's daughter, who shouted, For you to sit there and smile is disrespectful. You took my mother. Afterwards, the family were allowed to give impact statements. And as Diana's 18-year-old daughter, Nasia, spoke, Delvecchio flipped her the middle finger. Afterwards, she said she believed that the fact she looked like her mother had angered him. The family said that the verdict and the sentence were a welcome relief, and they felt as though Diana's voice had finally been heard. In the aftermath of the murder, Diana's family would go on to form Diana's Voice, which was an organization to help make changes in 911 call centers throughout the nation. They outlined several consistent problems, not only in Dallas but across the nation, including shortage of employees, outdated tracking equipment, overworked employees, and slow response times. Diana's Voice also works to stand up against domestic violence, to bring awareness and education. Their attempt to sue the city and police department failed when U.S. District Judge David Godbey said that the government could not be held liable for the actions of its employees.
We want this to not happen to any other family. We want to educate my nieces and other young women on what a healthy relationship is.
We want the city to answer. We want the system to be fixed. That's what we want out of this. We want this to never happen to anybody again.
Diana Cook had turned to the criminal justice system for help, not only on that fateful day, but for years. While immediate action from Dallas police when they received that 911 call from Deanna may not have saved her life, it could have saved her family days of worry and saved them the trauma of finding her body. In Deanna's final moments on Earth, she used the very system that failed her to seal the fate of Delvecchio Patrick. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my lovely new Patreon supporters, I Mayers, Jessica, Dawn, Beth, and XX. In return for your support on Patreon, you get Morbidology merch, which includes t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, and fridge magnets. You also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as bonus content from some of the episodes and ad-free and early release episodes. You can also request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and you can sign up annually to get 15% off. The support on Patreon helps to defray the costs of freedom of information requests, hosting, archive subscriptions, and much, much more, and I am eternally grateful. Can I also ask a massive favour and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love reading your reviews and it's a great way to support a show that you like. Also make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the very end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Sheer Crime. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi guys, I'm Amy.
And I'm Kenzie.
And we're the hosts of the new true crime podcast, Sheer Crime.
We are old beauty school friends who reconnected a decade later to learn that not only did we now live in the same town, but we are both true crime fanatics.
Every week, in the comfort of my basement, cold drinks in hand, we discuss true crime documentaries and give our raw and uncensored take on the evil acts that occur in our world.
If COVID, quarantine, and working from home have you aching for a break from the same old, come hang with us on Sheer Crime.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else that you subscribe and listen.
New episodes are released every Wednesday, and bonus episodes are sprinkled in here and there.
We can't wait to hear from you.
And remember, never run with scissors. Bye.
Bye.